Print and Politics. This lecture is going to look at the development of print culture in the 18th and early 19th centuries. It will focus on newspapers, but also consider the wider implications of the revolution in print culture in this period. Any analysis of print culture should consider the reach, audience, and reception of the printed word. One aspect of this is the level of literacy, and it's clear national literacy rates are rising steadily throughout the 18th century. However, there are big regional differences. In particular, the levels of in manufacturing centres are generally around 10 to 15 percentage points lower. We also have information on functional literacy in this period, but this says nothing about how and often and with what effect these skills are put into practice. So literacy can be measured in more qualitative ways by looking at the demand for reading materials. It should also be borne in mind that the audience for print was not limited to those who were literate, and there was an expectation that the skills of reading and writing would be shared. The practice of reading aloud was not new, but it's clear throughout the period, there are more and more venues where sharing of information and reading of newspapers can take place. Coffee houses, public houses, and reading rooms, for example, are proliferating throughout the period. The total production of print culture also needs to be considered, alongside the more serious and intellectual books, broadsides, and debates. Are the popular verses, ballads, songs, and cartoons. The unlettered in provincial centres had a long tradition of making topical verses, and self-expression required neither schooling nor proficiency with pen or paper. All that was required was a topic and an audience. It was a form of communication that moved between the categories of the oral and the literate. There were no fixed boundaries in this category of literary endeavour. Verses moved between printed versions, homemade handwritten songbooks, and orally reproduced and reinvented forms. They lived in the memory of their audiences, and the printed forms often decorated the domestic interiors of the common people. Much of the oral material assembled by folklore collectors in the 19th century is now known to have existed in printed form in the 18th century. Songs, which were first written for sophisticated London theatre audiences, often passed into collective memory, and in reworked versions became part of the repertoire of local ballad singers. Political songs were thus derived from and directed towards the entire community, and their form ranges from the carefully composed political satire to instant doggerel. Few of these political songs specified how the songs should sound. The professional seller would sing his wares to prospective customers, selecting from his own stock of tunes whatever seemed to suit the metre and the content. Election songs, however, tended to specify the tune because it was crucial that all consumers recognised the tune and sang the same one. For example, a popular tune is Chevy Chase. It circulated in printed form from at least 1700 and featured in The Beggar's Opera, a ballad opera composed by John Gay in 1728. The most frequently cited tune for political songs was Heart of Oak, written for the London stage in 1759 by William Boyce with words by David Garrick. Print culture rarely functioned in isolation from other modes of communication. Print made constant reference to the formal and informal use of the human voice, and in turn, the various means of oral communication relied on the written word to enhance their effect. It also spread across the social spectrum, Women, too, are free to read the printed word, and many could do so. They participated not only as consumers, but also as producers and distributors. Turning particularly to newspapers then, the national political press, based in London, began to emerge in the 1780s, although London had had a thriving local press from the early 18th century. The Westminster Review calculated in 1829 that every London paper was read by at least 30 people. Perhaps the most significant national political paper is The Times, which was founded in 1785 and by the mid-19th century had reached a level of influence unprecedented in the history of journalism. In 1817, Thomas Barnes was appointed as editor and earned the Times the nickname of the Thunderer by his leading articles, which thundered for reform. The Times appealed to the forces of public opinion and quickly established itself as the voice of the emerging middle classes. There was also a thriving provincial press. Provincial towns across England had their own printers, and they created the work to keep themselves in business. By the mid-1740s, there were 381 printers, booksellers and engravers at work in 174 towns across the country. And by the 1790s, this had risen to almost 1,000 firms in 316 towns. Printers were well equipped to cope with the sudden demand for their services. A basic press, for example, could produce 200 copies an hour, and thus it was possible in the heat of an election contest to respond to an opponent's broadside within hours of its appearance on the street. Frank O'Gorman estimated that it was not unusual for 100 or more separate pieces of literature to be composed, printed, and circulated during a single campaign. Over the course of the 18th century, the larger provincial printers increasingly turned to newspapers to consolidate their position in the locality and provide a consistent form of income amongst their more seasonal businesses. The first provincial papers can be traced back to the Norwich Postboy, which was founded in 1701, but it was not until later in the century that they proliferated across the country. The proprietors of these early journals tended to be printers first and journalists second. Most news or comment was lifted out of the London press, and they contained very little original material. They rarely indulged in local news reporting, even of local events. For example, as late as 1815, when a meeting in Manchester was called against the new Corn Law, the speeches that were delivered were not reported in the local press. The average price of provincial papers in 1815 was about 7 pence per copy, falling to 4 pence after the reduction of stamp duty in 1836. This very high level of tax reduced the number of copies the newspapers sold. Most papers were weeklies, and occasionally there were bi-weekly papers. Heavy tax was not the only limiting factor. Freedom to publish parliamentary debates did not occur until 1771. And until Fox's Libel Act of 1792, judges rather than juries decided if issues were libelous. The rise of the provincial press was based around the middle class of the emerging industrial towns. These newspapers were very different from their earlier 18th century cousins. They used editorials and local reports as their main journalistic weapons. The first newspaper to develop these techniques was the Sheffield Register, published by Joseph Gale from 1787 to 1794. Other examples are the Manchester Guardian and the Leeds Mercury. These newspapers had an important effect on public opinion and on national politics. They helped, through editorial writing, to persuade local opinion to embark on reform agitation, and once reform protests had begun, they became the outlets to publicise them. The third strand of the press is the radical unstamped press, which emerged between around 1790 and lasted till about 1840. This emerged as part of the political reform movement. The unstamped papers emerged alongside the radical journals of the 1790s. They were not so much newspapers as cheap pamphlets and tracts, publicising works such as Paine's Right of Man. Repressive action by the government, including higher stamp duty and a requirement that printers be registered, meant that these papers disappeared during the French Wars, but they were revived immediately after the peace treaties of 1815 with a renewed upsurge of popular political discontent. The foremost paper was Cobbett's Political Register, which advocated a radical programme including the reform of taxation, the end of sinecures and corruption, and the extension of the franchise. The paper was a third of the prices of other papers and achieved a circulation of around 40,000 copies per week. Hannah Barker has claimed that the role of print in the political process was at once traditional and on the leading edge of change. Throughout the 18th century, contested elections, particularly in boroughs, had been accompanied by printed propaganda, which was largely conventional in its form. Only the volume seems to have changed as the decades passed. But as increasingly professional election agents began to draw up proper election accounts, so the relative efficiency of different forms of political communication could be calculated. And therefore, the printed press, as in other aspects of politics, became more professional, more commercial. Any study of print culture in the long 18th century must therefore contend with a paradox. In many ways, the 18th century was an age of satire, of press freedom, of the expansion of the printed medium, and witnessed the rise of mass literacy. On the other hand, restrictive legislation, a hostile government, censorship, the imprisonment of printers, publishers and proprietors, and heavy taxation countered this impression of an unfettered print culture. However, the inexorable rise of the three strands of the newspaper press, coupled with a radical reformist agenda they increasingly publicised, provided an atmosphere in which only a change of government was necessary for reform to be placed on a parliamentary agenda.